Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Most crimes committed by non-Native residents on reservation land usually fall into federal jurisdiction. A Supreme Court ruling more than 40 years ago took those cases out of tribal court. Many tribal legal experts say the overburdened federal court system fails to prosecute many cases effectively. Coming up, we look at four decades of the Oliphant versus Suquamish decision. We go live right after the news. Stay with us.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Wyoming U.S. Senator John Barrasso is in opposition of Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior. During confirmation hearings, he pressed her on fossil fuels and environmental issues, even raising his voice and shouting. One tribe in a state wants to clear up some points the senator raised, as Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner reports.
During the hearing, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso was critical of Deb Haaland's record on fossil fuel. Barrasso quoted a recent letter written by the Northern Arapaho Business Council about how the Wyoming tribe is just as reliant on fossil fuels as the rest of the state. However, he failed to mention that the same letter, the Northern Arapaho Business Council, said they are in support of Haaland's appointment. Council Chair Jordan Dresser said that, yes, the tribe is reliant on fossil fuels.
But also, on the other hand, it's like everybody else in Indian country, we're really excited about Deb. Because here's somebody who she's us. She's one of us.
Dresser is excited to work on making the tribe less fossil fuel dependent and is looking at solar and wind as viable alternatives. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
The Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources voted Thursday on Deb Haaland's nomination for Secretary of the Interior. It was approved 11-9. Many people in Indian country are watching, hopeful Haaland will make history as the first Native American cabinet secretary. A scam is targeting family members of missing persons across the country, including in Alaska, where several indigenous people have gone missing in the last year. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Alaska State Troopers spokesperson Austin McDaniel says scammers are searching social media posts to find relatives of missing persons.
And we'll locate phone numbers or names associated with missing persons, and they've been texting or contacting the phone numbers that are listed and claiming that they have that missing person or demanding ransom.
A trooper press release warning Alaskans about the scam says the caller or texter claims the missing person was kidnapped and is now sick and demands money for their safe return. An Alaska missing persons database lists over 150 cases spanning several decades, including those of five Alaska Native people reported missing in the Fairbanks area last year. McDaniel would not say whether the scammers are targeting family members of any particular cases.
All I have to say is that there have been multiple instances occurring within the state of Alaska.
McDaniel stresses that anyone contacted and asked to pay money for the return of a missing family member should not respond, but instead reach out to the law enforcement agency handling their case. McDaniel would not say whether anyone in Alaska has lost money as a result of the missing person scam. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and the heirs of the late Tlingit weaver Clissa Rizal have settled a lawsuit over Neiman Marcus selling a coat bearing resemblance to an Alaska Native raven's tail pattern. The lawsuit claimed the sale of the coat violated the Indian Arts and Crafts Act by misrepresenting the coat and infringed on copyrights. Defendants claim the design was in public domain but acknowledged the cultural significance. According to Sea Alaska, the parties have agreed on terms while the defendants admit no fault, wrongdoing, or liability. The defendants have agreed to work with the cultural nonprofit to resolve issues under Tlingit law and cultural protocols. No other terms were made public. The lawsuit was filed last spring. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homeland, so share with Dui via Skype. Should tribes be allowed to prosecute non-natives in tribal court? That was the question before the Supreme Court more than 40 years ago this month. The case was called Oliphant versus Suquamish. In 1973, Suquamish tribal police arrested a non-native man named Mark David Oliphant for allegedly assaulting an officer and resisting arrest. Oliphant fought his arrest, saying tribal courts have no jurisdiction over him. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. In the end, the court ruled in favor of Oliphant. The decision has sweeping implications for tribal jurisdiction. Since the ruling, Native legal scholars argue it diminishes tribal sovereignty, something that only Congress can do. Today, we're going to dig into this case and others that deal with criminal jurisdiction on tribal reservations. And we'll also talk about how the Violence Against Women Act is intended to fix part of the ruling, but with limited success. And we'd like to hear from you. Phone lines are open. The number to join us is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we are going to start off in Traverse City, Michigan. With us today is Matthew Fletcher. He is a law professor at Michigan State University's College of Law and the author of Turtle Talk blog. He is from the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Matthew, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Also here on the line from McLean, Virginia, is Mary Catherine Nagel. She's a partner at Pipestem and Nagel PC, and she is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Thank you for being with us today, Mary Catherine. Thanks for joining us for another Native America Calling.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. Good to be here.
And so we're going to depend on two of the both of you to tell us, you know, just kind of how huge of an impact this decision had on our Native Nation. So it's kind of a history lesson, but also applying it to what Native Nations are facing today. And so, Matthew, before we get into more of Oliphant versus Suquamish, let's get a quick history of criminal jurisdiction in Native America. What would you like to share to just kind of set things up?
Certainly. So, you know, the United States intervened in Indian country criminal jurisdiction in 1790 in the very first Congress under the U.S. Constitution, where it criminalized the act of trespassing into Indian country by an American citizen. And in that statute, Congress basically was asserting the power to control Indian country criminal jurisdiction. But it really didn't extend much federal criminal jurisdiction into Indian country until the 1880s. The 1880s are an incredibly momentous decade in federal Indian law and policy. It is also the beginning of the allotment era and a series of Supreme Court decisions that were really very important. Most notably, in 1883, the Supreme Court said that the federal government could not prosecute an Indian because the Indians were too uncivil. They were too savage to be prosecuted in federal court. It wouldn't be fair for Indian people to face justice in front of a federal judge. Congress quickly fixed that with the Major Crimes Act in 1885. And what that did effectively was strip tribes of the ability to prosecute serious crimes that occur on their reservation. But lower crimes, misdemeanors, less serious crimes, were still under the jurisdiction of the tribes. We thought until And even in 1968, when Congress passed the Indian Civil Rights Act, it just came right out and said, more or less, when tribes prosecute people, whoever they might be, it didn't say Indian or non-Indian, they have to follow the Indian Bill of Rights and provide basic constitutional rights protections. So again, until Oliphant, it was fair to say that Congress had never done anything to strip tribes of the ability to prosecute non-Indians for, you know, lesser offenses. But the Supreme Court said in 1978 that it doesn't matter, that nobody in their right mind would have believed that Indian people or Indian courts could prosecute non-Indians. That's why Congress never acted to take that ability away or that power away from tribes, because nobody would have thought in their right mind that tribes had that power. The court uses phrases like unspoken assumption, which, you know, for a lawyer is kind of a joke and an embarrassment to jurisprudence. It's pretty apparent that the court believed that Congress never stripped tribes of that jurisdiction because tribes or Indian people are inferior, and they just couldn't stand to have the idea that couldn't stand the notion that a tribal court would prosecute non-Indians, and decided to strip that power as a policy choice away from Indian tribes.
And so, Matthew, when you think of this case and just how much impact it's had, a decision that was made, you know, decades ago, what are your thoughts? If you could just switch things around, you know, what would you want to change? Is it time for this to go back to the Supreme Court?
I think it might be. Here's a couple of things that happened because of Oliphant. First of all, Oliphant sticks out horribly. In all of the bad decisions of Indian law, Oliphant might quite possibly be the worst. It reverses presumptions. Like you said at the beginning, only Congress or a tribe by agreement can strip or divest a tribe of its powers to do something as a government. Congress never did that. This was pure judicial fiat by the Supreme Court, an unelected, undemocratic body of, you know, the federal government. They did so because of their longstanding animus, racial animus toward Indian people and tribal governmental institutions. So it's what that case did set a precedent, I guess you could say, for a methodology at the court. The court started to think, we don't have to listen to what Congress thinks about self-determination. We don't have to listen to the executive branch and, you know, and its enforcement of its trust responsibilities. We're the court. We can actually do anything we want in Indian law. And for the next several decades, the court had basically done exactly that. And we're starting to see now with McGirt versus Oklahoma and a few other cases like Michigan versus Bay Mills and Herrera versus Wyoming that, in fact, the Supreme Court is starting to realize that the last few decades of Indian law jurisprudence that have followed Oliphant are really embarrassing to them. And I think they're starting to walk away from that and going back to the old presumptions, these understandings that it's the Indian law landscape is to be negotiated between Congress and the tribes themselves, not dictated by a judicial branch of the government. So I think there is a possibility for, you know, the use of a case like McGirt as an example of a judicial methodology, a judicial practice that is consistent with where the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary generally are supposed to sit in the federal government as sort of lesser branches of government that do not dictate policy. And I think if the right case came to the court, the right vehicle, as we say in the field, I think you could see some possibility there for the court to rethink its Oliphant decision. If I had to go back to 1978 and advise the court, what I would do is simply tell them, just follow the law. You know, the law is tribes possess powers until Congress takes it away. And they simply did not do that in that case. And I don't know what the outcome would have been, but the main thing I would have said was, to the court, if you're going to adopt a rule like this, apply it on a tribe-by-tribe basis. Navajo, for example, is a treaty that more or less guarantees their ability to prosecute crimes on their reservation, regardless of race. And a few other tribes have similar things. And I think that those a vehicle from a tribe like that with stronger treaty rights, perhaps, or a really important and well-developed tribal government and tribal criminal justice capacity, should be allowed to explore the possibility of prosecuting non-Indians. And the Supreme Court and the federal judiciary should go along with that.
And so, Matthew, there's a lot of things that are in this, and especially when we talk about jurisdiction. And, you know, we know there are a lot of people in this listening audience who see how much this case affects them, their family, their community. And if you have any kind of take on this, you can join us too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to your calls. You can ask questions too. We're learning along with our guests today about how all of this affects, you know, our communities and exactly how crimes are prosecuted in our tribal nations. So you heard a little bit of the background. We're going to get deeper into this. But what if things were different? What would be lifted? What would have changed? You think of different cases that have gone on the federal side because it was against a non-Native person committing a crime on our Native nations. What if things had reversed? What would change? You can give us a ring today. We look forward to hearing your thoughts today. We are taking a look at the Oliphant versus Squamish decision and the big impact that it's had. We know there is also another chapter to this when it comes to violence against women and children in our Native nations. There was a provision that was put in to VAWA that might have provided some doors opening for prosecution. We'll hear more about that coming up after the break. But again, we want to hear from you today. And when you think of treaty rights, just like Matthew mentioned, and you think of that going against some of these decisions, what are your thoughts? I know you think a lot about treaties and those decisions, those agreements that were made by our elders, our ancestors, and you see how things have played out through the decades. What would you want to say today? Give us a ring. We look forward to hearing from you. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And if we have any of our folks who are in the Native arena or the law arena, and you want to share some thoughts about how much this decision has impacted your work as a lawyer, you can give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And of course, our tribal leaders, if you're out there, you want to say some thoughts, we look forward to hearing from you as well. But everybody is welcome. Anybody can call in. Call in now. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. We look forward to hearing from you. Native quilts are more than blankets to keep you warm. They can tell stories and are also used to honor someone special. On the next Native America Calling, we're talking with Native quilters from various cultures about their passion for the craft and the larger purpose of their work. We hope you can join us.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we are talking about Oliphant versus Squamish today. It's a 40-year-old Supreme Court ruling that stripped tribes of the right to prosecute non-Native people in tribal courts. If you have something you'd like to share about this, give us a call. The number to join is 1-800-996-2848. With us on the line, out of McLean, Virginia, is Mary Catherine Nagel. She's a partner at Pipestem and Nagel PC. She is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Also here, too, is Matthew Fletcher out of Traverse City, Michigan. He is a law professor at Michigan State University's College of Law and author of the Turtle Talk blog. He is from the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. Thank you both for being here. And when we think of this case, there is a lot to consider. And so Let's get straight into the case. What are some of the highlights or some of the things that stand out, even from the testimony that was given? Matthew, anything you want to share?
Well, this case was decided at a time when, you know, you didn't have the internet and nobody really knew anything about what was going on in Indian country. So it's apparent the court knew nothing about the Suquamish tribal court system. It was a relatively new tribe, and what I mean by that is they had just recently had their treaty rights acknowledged in the Bolt decision. They had really been ignored by the federal government for a long time, and we were starting to put together an actual governing structure within the Port Madison Reservation. Additionally, the court spends a lot of time talking about how very few people are actually citizens of the Suquamish tribe. And I'm not sure where they got that number from. They said there were only 50 citizens and several thousand non-Indians living on the reservation. And they said, just as a matter of policy, that's not acceptable to us. By us, I mean, of course, the Supreme Court saying this. I'm not sure where they got that number from. And I know that there are certainly more than 50 tribal citizens now at Suquamish. And when I worked there briefly in 2001, there certainly were more than 50 citizens. So a lot more, I would say. And so the court really took the worst conceivable point of view factually from Indian country to try to adopt a much broader opinion on what tribal courts are like. If this case had arisen, say, like I mentioned, Navajo, with a long-standing court system and a fully functioning government with a lot of capacity, it would have been incongruous to say that Navajo, which is the size of West Virginia, couldn't prosecute a bunch of people who were on the reservation. They picked this case on purpose, a small tribe that was heavily allotted. Much of the land on the reservation at Port Madison had been leased out by the Department of the Interior for pennies on the dollar to non-Indians for, you know, basically as a giveaway from the U.S. to private citizens, non-Indian citizens in Washington State. So the court pays no attention to this background, other than to say we have a tiny tribe that's just getting its government started. There's only a few tribal members. They don't own the land, et cetera, et cetera. There's another interesting side point to this, and I'm not sure how it cuts, but there was a co-defendant in this case, a guy named Bellegarde. And Oliphant was actually arrested twice. You mentioned he was arrested during the summer, during Chief Seattle days. He was also arrested in the fall with this guy Bellegarde. Bellegarde was an Indian. So there was a co-defendant who was an Indian. He probably was an Indian from a tribe, you know, in the, I think those of you are from, your listeners from North Dakota or Montana have probably, I probably know people who are native who are named Bellegarde. I know I did when I lived out there. So I'm assuming the co-defendant in this case was actually Indian, and the trial court sort of just poo-pooed it and said it doesn't matter. He's not a member, and we're just going to treat him as a non-Indian. The final thing I wanted to bring up about this case is that the court, when I say the court is evincing racial animus, I think they were in a way that the justice that wrote the opinion thought was funny. He was known to be a humorous guy. He's also known to be an overt racist. And he wrote into an opinion, into the Oliphant opinion, several quotations from the 1883 case I mentioned before, Crow Dog, where the court said that Indian people are ignorant and savage and there's no way they can understand what's going on. He cut out all the parts about Indians and put Oliphant into there and said, there's no way Oliphant could understand what's going on in tribal court. Not because Oliphant, as a white person, was savage or uncivilized and unlettered, because he is just somebody who wasn't able to participate in the politics at Suquamish. And to take that Crow Dog case, the language of incredible virulent racism, and flip it on its head, to apply it against tribal jurisdiction really is quite disturbing. And again, I'm pretty sure that our justice who wrote this opinion thought it was kind of funny to do it that way, and because it doesn't make much sense to do that.
And here we are today. And Matthew, also about when this decision came out, And you think of the temperature of the country, also some of the Native power movement that was going on during the time. Did any of those things, you think, have an influence and seeing Natives as radicals and you know, how could somebody be tried in the radicals' court? Did any of that, did anyone ever think that or that come into play?
I have no doubt it did. And it probably came into play in the same way that you see in other decolonized countries where, say, in an African country where a lot of the property, a lot of the business activity is conducted by the colonizers who complain virulent all the time that they're having their property taken away from this new government, this indigenous government. The justice who wrote the Oliphant opinion, Justice Rehnquist, wrote an opinion a few years later that is very that is sort of unreported, and it's hard to find a copy of it, where he just comes right out and says, I don't think tribes should have civil jurisdiction over non-Indians either, because tribes will just take back the property that they lost. And that's really at the heart, I think, of the unspoken heart, so to speak, of the Oliphant opinion and some of the opinions from that generation of Supreme Court jurisprudence. It's really about making sure that, you know, Indian people, you lost it fair and square, you're conquered, shut up and accept it and move along.
And we know how that message goes over. Go ahead, join us. You're getting more details on this. I know you're thinking something, so go ahead, dial in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Mary Catherine, just thinking of the history of this case, anything more you want to add or things that have really impacted you thinking as a practicing lawyer today? Go ahead.
Sure. You know, as Professor Fletcher has pointed out, Oliphant is a very problematic case. And, you know, he mentioned the way in which Chief Justice Rehnquist cited to precedent from the 1880s, but Chief Justice Rehnquist also cited to Johnson v. McIntosh. And, of course, if you read that case in 1823, it says, you know, tribal nations legal title to their land because they're racially inferior savages and heathens. And of course, Chief Justice Rehnquist in 1978 didn't quote that language, but he quoted that case. And that case rests on the platform of tribal nations are denied this legality, this legal title to their land because of their racial inferiority. And basically in 1978, Chief Justice Rehnquist said, well, this, we decided in Johnson and McIntosh they can't claim legal title to their lands, therefore how can they exercise jurisdiction over it? And that is, I think, a very actually unconstitutional jurisprudence and way of framing the case, and I think would not hold up today in front of the court. And I think one of the other problems with which Professor Fletcher mentioned is this idea that Chief Justice Rehnquist espoused that, well, and he didn't really have a precedent or authority to cite for this, but he just kind of said, you know, at the end of the day, it's just kind of unfair that this poor guy, Oliphant, you know, yeah, he may have, you know, by the way, what he actually did in that case was got drunk and beat up a tribal law enforcement officer, and then got, you know, the tribal law enforcement had to chase him. He engaged in a high-speed chase that risked the lives of many. And Chief Justice Rehnquist said, well, it's just not fair that he's going to be hauled into tribal courts when he can't vote in the elections of that tribal government. We can't have our being hauled into these foreign courts where, you know, they're going to have people that are not from their community and they can't vote for, you know, the government that's going to pick who the judges are that sit on the court. That's just unfair. Well, that's crazy. I mean, imagine if the Supreme Court said, you know what, Kansas, you can't prosecute citizens of Colorado when they come onto into Kansas land and rape and murder women that are Kansas citizens, because you don't let citizens of Colorado vote in your election. So therefore, you shouldn't have jurisdiction over them when they come onto your land and commit crimes. The Supreme Court would never reach that decision. That would upset our understanding of how the 50 states work together as one unit in the United States if that were the case. But that is exactly what the court did in Oliphant. And it is wrong on so many levels and has caused so much harm and trauma and violence in Indian country. You know, we could sit here and talk for hours about how horrific the Oliphant decision truly is.
And Mary Catherine, when you first learned about this case, I'm guessing you also spent a big part of it in law school. What was your initial reaction? Did this make you say, I really need to go into law?
Well, no one in my law school had me read it. Of course, I went to a law school. I wanted to study environmental law. I grew up near one of the worst Superfund sites in the world, which is northeastern Oklahoma, where the Quapaw Reservation and parts of Cherokee Nation's reservation and several other reservations were horrifically mined by the BIA in World War II and then never cleaned up. And I could go on and on about that disaster. So I went to law school to study environmental law, and I went to Tulane Law School. And to be honest, they didn't have an Indian law program. So I did, and I was very excited about environmental law at the time, and still am to a certain extent, but obviously I'm practicing much more Indian law than environmental law these days. You know, I did take a race theory, critical race theory seminar, and in that class, asked my professor. So I was always very fixated on Wooster v. Georgia because my great-great-great-grandfather actually worked on the case and was an attorney at the time, of course, wasn't allowed to practice in any kind of federal or state court because he was Native, and Natives weren't allowed to practice law back then in courts outside of our tribal nations. And, you know, going back to another just absolute, like, lie that is embedded in Oliphant is this idea that tribes exercising criminal jurisdiction for non-Indian American citizens is a new phenomena, which is what Chief Justice Rehnquist called it. My great-great-great-great-grandfather was Speaker of our tribal council when they passed the law to create our Cherokee Nation Supreme Court. We had a Supreme Court 20 years before the state of Georgia had one, and we prosecuted anyone who came onto Cherokee Nation lands and committed a crime, and that's what Wooster in 1832 was all about. And the Supreme Court in that case, when Georgia said, actually, there's no way tribes can exercise criminal jurisdiction over American citizens within, you know, tribal nation land, so it has to be the surrounding state. That is our area of jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not, Georgia. You don't have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indian American citizens who come onto tribal lands because the tribal nation has that jurisdiction. So as Professor Matthew Fletcher points out, the Supreme Court in 1708 just didn't apply the law. They just got to the conclusion that they felt was the best in that moment. You know, nine men on that court. Of course, we've never had a Native justice, and we didn't have a Native law clerk until recently. Justice Gorsuch hired the first Native law clerk, citizen of a tribal nation in the history of the United States that we know of. So, you know, all of this just leads to, you know, the reality that Oliphant is a very, very, very problematic case.
And what do you think it would take to fix things?
Well, as the court said, and at the very end of its opinion, the final two or three sentences, and as Professor Fletcher alluded to, Congress has the authority to restore this jurisdiction. I think specifically the court in Oliphant said to recognize this jurisdiction, or I actually don't have the exact quote on top of my head, but the point is that, and that is the exact authority that Congress used in 2013 when Congress reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act and restored tribal criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians for crimes when non-Indians commit crimes of domestic violence, dating violence, and violation of protection orders. We have a lot of allies in Congress right now who are interested in a congressional full Oliphant fix. So that's really exciting. And I think although these issues do not always divide along partisan lines, I mean, for instance, Justice Gorsuch, who is a Republican appointee, you know, probably just wrote one of the... Well, a lot of us consider it to be one of the best Supreme Court decisions a tribal nation has ever won, right? And we've got allies like, you know, Chickasaw Nation citizen Tom Cole, who's a Republican congressman. But there has been significant Republican opposition to restoration of tribal criminal jurisdiction, especially from a few key Republican senators. And that was, and some, you know, other Republicans in the House historically back in 2013 that made things very challenging. And so we do have a situation right now with a democratically controlled White House and Congress, House of Congress, and then barely by a very thin margin in the Senate, we have a chance to push that. And it's not currently being pushed right now. And I don't, you know, see any plans for it to be pushed anytime soon. Folks in both the Senate and the House are very focused on a VAWA reauthorization bill that would restore additional categories of non-Indian crimes, of tribal jurisdiction over non-Indian crimes. But as it was drafted in 2019 in H.R. 1585, it's not a full Oliphant fix. But that conversation is starting to happen. And you will notice that when Senator Warren was running for president, when then Senator Harris was running for president, a lot of these presidential candidates, especially on the Democratic side, put in their campaign platforms saying, if elected president, I will work on a full Oliphant fix. And in fact, President Joe Biden ended up adopting similar language, not quite as strong as actually Senator Harris had in her platform at the time before she became the VP candidate. But the point is that this is now a conversation we're having with folks outside of Indian country on the Hill and in these positions of power who understand what that means and why it needs to be done. And I think that I don't know if it'll be in the next 4 years or in the next 10 years or what, but I do think we're moving towards a full Oliphant 6. I really do. And I also think with the addition of Justice Gorsuch, we now have a champion who approaches tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction and all these issues with an intellectual rigor that many justices in the past just didn't bother to apply because for various reasons that I think rested mostly on prejudice, but we could talk for hours about that as well. And so, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with Justice Amy Coney Barrett. My hope, and I think a lot of our hopes, is that she will follow her colleague, Justice Gorsuch, who is also an originalist as she is, and sort of look to him for guidance on these Indian law cases that might come before the court. And, you know, as I think, it's, you know, we have a case coming up in Cooley, and it'll be very interesting to see what Justice Barrett does in that case.
Well, thank you for that. We got to go to break here, but again, you are invited into this conversation. To join us, all you have to do is dial 1-800-996-2848. Today, we're talking about criminal jurisdiction over our Native nations. And do you think tribes should be able to arrest and prosecute non-Natives who commit crimes within our Native nations, within reservation boundaries? What do you think about this decision that says no to a lot of it? 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Go ahead, dial in, tell us why or why not you think tribes should be able to prosecute and arrest non-Natives on our lands. Again, want to hear from you at 1-800-996-2848. I see the calls are coming in. We're going to go to our listening audience here right after the break. But again, if you want to join us, now's the time. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Thanks for tuning in today here on Native America Calling as we take a look at law in our Native nations. There is more ahead. Stay tuned. We have more to share. Again, phone lines are open. Give us.
If you're a Native American entrepreneur looking to expand or start up a business, you should know about the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program, a federal program encouraging private lenders to make the business loan you need. The Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can support you. Information available by emailing dci@bia.gov. That's dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we're talking tribal jurisdiction, the Oliphant versus Suquamish case. If you have any thoughts, dial in 1-800-996-2848. Let's hear what people are thinking out there. We're going to first say hi to Nick in northern New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Nick, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I've on the road today and driving through many small pueblos here in New Mexico and having driven around this country a lot, it can be a little scary from time to time to, you know, be driving through a small jurisdiction in the South or anywhere, really, whether it's a county or a state that has different laws than the laws I'm used to. And frankly, I think that's a good thing. People should have the jurisdiction and the authority to govern themselves and as well as those people who are visiting where they live. And even though it might be a little intimidating to me to travel on to some native land and have to face the consequences of my actions based on the local laws, I frankly think that's a good thing. The more awareness that anyone can have about the reality of these borders and the sovereignty that Native Americans should have over their land, I think is a good thing.
Well, thanks for your thoughts, Nick, there in northern New Mexico. Safe travels to you. We now say hi to Herbert, who is in Taos, New Mexico, listening in on KUNM. Herbert, thanks for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Thank you for everything that you do. I want to comment that I think absolutely tribes should have complete law enforcement jurisdiction over anyone on their sovereign lands because tribes are sovereign. It seems like a pretty cut and dry issue. And thank you for allowing me to comment.
All right, Herbert, thanks for giving us a ring. We now go to Marion, who is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening in on KUNM. Marion, thanks for giving us a ring. Go ahead. What are you thinking?
Good morning. I want to let everybody know that. When I tell my friends who are non-Indian that we can't prosecute people who inflict crimes on us back home on the res, they don't believe it. They can't understand it. They just think it's so unfair. And I recall, trying to call the police to come for a domestic violence situation on the reservation. And it took a long time for the police to come because on the reservation, we don't hardly have any police of our own to take care of us. And our jail is so tiny. It's been the same size since like the early 70s. And you can't even jail your own people because there's just too tiny of jails or no jails at all in the community. And I think that if we got a fair chance to prosecute non-Indians on the reservation, then there would be less crime inflicted on women and children. And there would be less disabilities created by this. And it would cost the tribe and the state and the feds a lot less money in terms of taking care of us people who have gotten brain damage, become paraplegic, blind, like my friends and I who have been taken advantage of and hurt by non-Indians on the reservation. And I hope that the Supreme Court would look fairly on at us and look at us as equals now. We've showed that we can become accomplished, become MDs and attorneys and such, and hold jobs and buy homes and everything just the same as non-Indians. And I hope that, one day it can be equal so that we can get funding for jails and for our own prison system so that we can rehabilitate our own people as maybe, well, as non-Indians and to the true nature of being a good human being.
All right, thank Marion, you. Thank you. Thank you for your call. And also here, too, on the line, we got Melvin coming out of Santee, Nebraska, tuned in on KZYK. Melvin, thank you for giving us a ring. Go ahead. Your thoughts?
Yes, good afternoon. Here on the Santee, we retroceded about 14 years ago, which meant we went from public law 280 state back under federal control. But the problem here is we have tribal court that you could be arrested and charged there, state court or federal court, where a non-Indian would just go under state court. The jurisdiction problem here has been like from my house to the casino is 10 miles. They have state police on that road and tribal police. The tribal police and the state police can ticket me or arrest me, but the tribal police can only arrest me and not a non-Indian. And it just seems so, how do we get to this point? It's just so confusing and mixed up. You don't know if you get charged, what court you're going to end up in, federal, state, or tribal. And it's really a confusing system that is in place here. I hope we get some rules that can help regulate and make us understand what the rules are or what the jurisdiction is.
All right, Melvin, good to hear your voice. Thanks for giving us a ring. Let's take one more. We have Tova in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Thanks for giving us a ring. Go ahead. You're on air.
My question is, what would your guests think about amending the Indian Civil Rights Act to provide a right to appointed counsel for persons who are facing incarceration in tribal court systems who are indigent? And, of course, funding would have to come with that as well. But now, everyone in a non-Indian court whether a federal or state court, even for a misdemeanor who's facing any jail time, who's indigent, is entitled to appointed counsel. And non-Indians who are in tribal courts, when the tribal courts take jurisdiction under VAWA, have a right to appointed counsel, but Native Americans don't have that right. So that's my question. As long as tribal courts have adopted the mainstream methodology of incarceration, should people facing incarceration in tribal court who are indigent, who don't have money, have the right to appointed counsel under the Indian Civil Rights Act?
All right. Thank you for that, Tova. Matthew, I'll go to you. Anything for our caller?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And, you know, the Indian Civil Rights Act was, primarily passed in 1968. And an initial draft of it put in the Gideon versus Wainwright ruling, which was, everybody is entitled to appointed counsel if they're, they can't afford an attorney. And the federal government was, the Department of Justice in particular, said, no, take that out of there. I suspect because they thought they could still get Gideon overruled, and they didn't want Congress to ratify the principle of Gideon, which at that time was only 4 or 5 years old. But I want you to know, and I'm sure you are aware, that in lots of places in Indian country, tribes do provide appointed attorneys for indigent defendants. And indigency is, in the tribes that I work with here in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, is often defined as twice the poverty rate. So it's much more expansive in parts of Indian country than you would see elsewhere. But you raise an incredibly good point, which is under VAWA 2013, non-Indians get the best civil rights, criminal rights protections of any person in the United States prosecuted. You know, there are judges that are prosecuting people in state courts that are not even lawyers, thousands of them around the country. And, that's a requirement under VAWA 2013 that the judge be law trained. It's ironic that in so many places where VAWA 2013 has been incorporated and implemented by tribes, that the non-Indians get better protections than the tribal citizens do, and also non-member Indians. So I completely agree with you that there's sort of this structural equal protection problem with VAWA 2013 as well.
Thank you for that. And Tova, thanks for calling in. We now go to Roy in Akiak, Alaska, tuned in on KYUK. Roy, thank you for giving us a ring. You're on air.
Yeah, good morning. Exactly, previous person mentioned, it's a racial equality issue. Seems like that really sticks out. It's like we get recognized for being tribes, yet not recognized because of the difference in color. An equality issue really shows out as long as you're a certain color, you get more rights in the face of the judicial system. Seem like, how can it be in your thinking to your guests, make that more equal approach into recognizing? It's like we are recognized, yet not recognized. What's your response to that? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for giving us a ring, Roy. Mary Catherine, anything for Roy?
Sure. You know, I understand these concerns and very much sympathize with them. And I agree with Professor Fletcher, you know, this is an important issue. I do think, however, there's oftentimes a lot of misunderstanding, and people seem to think that you mentioned any time in jail, you know, or I think our caller mentioned any time in jail, if you're in state or federal court, you get an attorney, and that's actually not the case. You know, it can vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court has spoken in terms of what the Bill of Rights provides, and I believe it's 6 months. Incarceration, but I'd have to actually go back and look, and that may have changed. But anyways, in any event, it's not just one day in jail, you get an attorney, and it's just not quite that simple. And so I think that's just important to keep in mind, that it's not as black and white as folks might present it. And I've certainly represented a lot of Native clients who have been arrested and incarcerated in federal or state jails. and not released and not given an attorney for a bit. And it's very concerning. So, again, I do think our tribes need to provide, effective assistance of counsel and provide indigenous people with attorneys. And I think that's a question of tribal sovereignty as a citizen of Cherokee Nation. You know, I mean, that's my job to advocate for those policies within my nation. And I do hesitate a little bit with this idea that the federal government should be telling tribal governments how to effectuate justice. I don't think that our tribal governments are incapable of figuring out how to solve these problems, but I will say a lot of federal laws have tied their hands. The Indian Civil Rights Act, for instance, limits the amount of sentencing that tribes can issue for different sentences. And, you know, we also have a lot of different federal laws out there, whether it's from Congress or the Supreme Court and their jurisprudence, limiting the ability of tribes to tax in the same way that states and local municipalities can. And so, you know, I also agree that it would need to be funded, right? Like I think there's a federal trust duty and responsibility to fund tribal governments and tribal courts and tribal law enforcement. And we haven't really seen that, even though I think that is definitely embedded in hundreds of different treaties that the support of tribal governments in exchange for the lands that now comprise the United States. So I agree it's an issue. I just think it's not as simple as, well, if they're in federal court, they automatically will definitely get an attorney or in state court all the time, and they wouldn't in tribal court. It's not quite accurate, and it's a little bit more complex than that.
And so, Mary Catherine, definitely, when we think of how much this is applied to our Native nations, and we think of VAWA, and of course, if you can give us an update too on where reauthorization of that stands. But anything more you would like our listeners to know about ways VAWA has changed some of the Oliphant impact?
Well, I think if you talk to folks at the tribes where this is, where they implemented VAWA, they will say, or in conversations I've had, that a lot of the non-Indian criminals who had learned that they could commit these crimes with impunity, that no one would arrest them or prosecute them for committing these crimes because the tribal government, the local government on the ground didn't have jurisdiction. Now that the tribal government is arresting and prosecuting for these crimes, many of those folks are repeat offenders, which is also often the case in domestic violence situations. And so whereas before, when their spouse or their partner would call police and call 911, and the police would have to say, well, your partner or your spouse is non-Indian, unfortunately, you don't have jurisdiction. And then the partner could just, laugh and continue his or her abuse. We're now seeing situations where tribal law enforcement are showing up and people are shocked. And now there's a ripple effect where people are saying, okay, something changed. Now the tribe can arrest us for these crimes. And so maybe we want to think twice before we abuse Native women and men. Men are also victims of domestic violence, too. So it has had a huge effect. But unfortunately, until we have a full Oliphant fix, it's just not what we need, right? We need a full Oliphant fix. So VAWA, the next round of VAWA, is looking to restore additional categories of non-Indian tribal criminal jurisdiction, including sexual assault, obstruction of justice, like elder abuse, child abuse. These things are not covered right now. Trafficking. So when, for instance, right now, under the current restoration of VAWA, because it's limited domestic violence, dating violence, and violation of protection orders, unless you have the children listed on a protective order, if a non-Indian, let's say stepdad, is beating an Indian mom and the children, the tribe can prosecute for the crimes committed against the mom, but not the children. Those are just freebies that he gets to commit without any kind of consequence. And that's horrific. And it has really endangers the lives of our children. And it also teaches them that they're not valued and that people can just abuse them and get away with it. And that's very problematic. We also have issues of tribal law enforcement showing up and non-Indian abusers beating up, trying to, hit or shoot at tribal law enforcement. And under the current law, they can assault tribal law enforcement, and there's nothing the tribe can do because, again, the tribal law officer and the perpetrator here in this instance are not in a domestic or dating relationship, and that is a jurisdictional requirement because of Oliphant and then under VAWA 2013. So this new VAWA, it's largely going to mirror the text of the statute of H.R. 1585, which passed in the House in April of 2019. There really won't be a lot of changes to that bill as it gets moved forward in the Senate. in the House.
Mm-hmm. Mary Catherine, we got to wrap things up. We're out of here. We got to look more into all of this. Thank you to everybody we heard from today. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll meet you here tomorrow.
Did you know COVID financial relief in the form of forgivable PPP loans is available to small business owners and independent contractors, including artists? DreamSpring has worked with New Mexicans looking to open or expand their business for over 25 years, and now they're helping provide PPP loans. Information, including how to qualify, at dreamspring.org. That's dreamspring.org. DreamSpring supports this program.
Ah, chas bukani. Chitin kutinaksum lu and chas biot in chashit ya twaske. In chun kanzuch and zintumist in chashit chasech spukani's upenhech zeal 2021. Kol naucht smeet, chkolkol tausis, chskeli such mariam yet sachem. Chkoyment healthcare.gov. Uchwa chkolkol tausit 1-800-318-2596. Hietz mamit and centers kol Medicare u Medicaid services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.